got the password?
Walt sent me.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 142 of Walt Sent Me, the podcast where we look at the cinematic legacy of the Walt Disney Company and its various subsidiaries. My name is Todd Liebenow, and with me is the talented Kristen Lopez.
Hello.
And this time we are talking about a film that comes from the Miramax days of Disney, 1999's The Talented Mr. Ripley. We've also got a short to talk about and a few news items. It's been a while since we've recorded, but there have been a few bits and pieces of things that have come out there. Let's actually start with something that just hit today as we're recording, and I'm very excited about this. We got our very first look at the new special that is coming out on Disney Plus here in October, Muppet Haunted Mansion. And I got to say, I was pretty excited by the trailer because, of course, I love all things Muppets. But it was, I thought, really cool, just the bits of glimpses we've got of things where they're really, you know, incorporating the imagery that we know from the Haunted Mansion into this. You've got Miss Piggy with her head in the crystal ball. You've got Fozzie Bear, looks like playing the Hatbox Ghost in this. So bringing out something that is kind of inside baseball thing for the deep dive Disney fans there. But Kristen, what's your take on what we've seen so far on Muppet Haunted Mansion?
I'm in a bit of an advantage because I've seen it. the trailer looked very cute. It's definitely a very sweet little short movie that I think should please a lot of people.
Well, that's good. Is it going to please us Muppet diehards, or are we just, you know, we'll eat up anything that's Muppets, you know?
It's still very much in line with what the Muppets are being utilized for on Disney Plus. You know, under 50-minute type of things where, you know, it's just kind of put them in Disney-centric things and hopefully magic will happen. You know, it's not the greatest thing they've ever done, but I think that at this point, we're not going to get there at any point in time. So it's certainly better, I think, than they've been used in the past.
Mm. Well, I, of course, am very much looking forward to it. I thought it was cool that in the trailer we got to see some Muppets we haven't seen for a while show up, a few characters from like the Muppets Tonight days and things like that. So, you know, that's kind of a forgotten part of Muppet history. So I'm kind of glad to see that there. But yeah, that's coming out here in early October. Definitely looking forward to that. Let's talk some Marvel stuff. We got our second look at a trailer for The Eternals that gave us some new things. This thing's looking really trippy. And then, of course, we got Spider-Man No Way Home finally. First in kind of a weird leak type of situation, and then they finally unleashed it. So, Kristen, any thoughts on these ones coming up?
Eternals continues to be something I want to see. I love the cast. I love Richard Madden. It looks good. I don't know anything about the plot. I can't tell you what it is, but it certainly looks ambitious, and I'm excited for it.
You know, that's the thing that I keep going back to is that it looks ambitious, and yeah, like you said, I don't know anything about this part of the world, these characters. I actually, on my other podcast just a week or so ago, had DJ Valentine on there from Simplistic Reviews podcast, and DJ is one of the people that I probably turn to most when it comes to, you know, comics. This guy knows comics, and we were talking a little bit about Eternals, and he was saying how he's excited for it, but he's also worried. He's excited because it's it looks interesting, and Chloe Zhao is directing it, and you know, he says probably this is the best director they've ever had with something, but he's like, Eternals is tough for the non-comic fan to get into. So he's like, you know, is this going to be difficult for just the casual Marvel fan who just knows the movies to get into?
I mean, I definitely think so. You know, we're getting into more esoteric territory now that all of the foundational stuff has been released. So I'm definitely here for it. I think after seeing Shang-Chi, I'm excited to see some of the newer directions that come out, if only because I think that it makes the Marvel stuff interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of trying to make it more interesting, I mean, everybody's got their own idea about where Spider-Man No Way Home is going. What did you think of the trailer?
You know, I think I watched it when it came out, and I completely forgot that it existed. The Spider-Man thing is not for me.
Oh, Kristen, you disappoint me.
Sorry. Yeah, I've seen, I think I saw the first Tom Holland one, I think. I saw one of them. Yeah, that was it.
So you're not the person there that's going, oh, they've clearly changed things around and they put Tom Holland's head on Tobey Maguire's body in the trailer to fool you and all that kind of stuff, you know, because all those crazy rumors are going around out there.
I mean, I think all Peter Parkers are played by one man anyway, so it wouldn't surprise me.
Well, you know, I'm kind of preparing myself for, you know, the internet to explode, you know, out of disappointment when all the things that they've said they think are going to happen in this thing don't happen. I mean, this either is going to be everybody's dream or it's going to be where just everybody loses their mind because they've created all these possible scenarios that don't end up playing out.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a lot of, you know, fans for the Spider-Man franchise and they're frightening. So I just don't plan to be on the internet that day when the movie comes out.
All right. Well, you mentioned Shang-Chi, and I haven't seen it yet. A lot of people have. A lot of people are really going nuts because the box office is somewhat coming back thanks to Shang-Chi. But do you want to give a few thoughts on the movie since you've seen it?
I loved it. It's actually very upsetting that they did not decide to do some sort of premier access for it because I'd have bought it the next day after seeing it. I had a lot of fun with it. I knew nothing going in. I think it's easily one of the most beautifully filmed Marvel movies that we've seen. Color, lighting, who knew those were things we actually wanted in this grim, dark landscape. You know, the casting is great. Everybody's on the ball. It was great to not necessarily see, you know, big beefcake guys. I think just the fact that they were really interested in telling a story was really important. And my family will tell you, I don't talk about Shang-Chi without shouting out Shang-Chi's hot dad, who is our villain of the movie.
I was going to say, that's the villain, isn't it?
Yeah.
are we back in sexy Jafar territory here, Kristen?
Oh, no, this transcends like all of that. Okay. If you're on Twitter, most people who have seen the movie, like they know what I'm talking about. is he the villain or is he the romantic leading man that this movie really deserves? It's great. I loved it. I can't wait for it to come to digital on November 12th on Disney Plus Day, where I can watch it again.
That's right. They're doing this big thing on November 12th where they're going to unleash a bunch of things. And I don't know if they're going to, you know, kind of hint to some stuff in the future. All these services now are doing these big days. The Netflix one is coming up in a few days here. So, you know, they're
marketing scheme 101. Yeah, fake holiday.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, jumping back to Shang-Chi real quick here, though. I mean, where are you at? I've never gotten the impression that Kristen is much of a martial arts movie person.
Nope.
So how did that square with you? You know,
I actually really liked it. I'm not a martial arts movie person at all. And, again, I think the story and just the bizarreness of it. I mean, this is a movie that we're talking about, the Eternals. This is a movie that has like Electragon in it. with the whole like backstory. It's wild. And I think that the casting and the weird Shakespearean father, son, King Lear thing, just really helps get you into it. I was charmed by every single thing in this movie.
Excellent. Well, I am a kung fu movie type of person, so I am definitely looking forward to it. Just haven't been able to get out there and see it yet. So that is in my future. All right. Now, before we move on to things here, I don't want to steal any thunder from Kristen's other podcast projects, but she has something that happened on one of her other shows here recently that very much is something we want to highlight here, because we're all about Disney stuff here. And she got to talk to somebody who basically, when I hear her name, I think first and foremost of her contribution to the Disney catalog of stuff, and that is Haley Mills. So we want to hear about Kristen chatting with Haley Mills here.
Yeah, Haley Mills has a new autobiography out called Forever Young, and I on my podcast, Ticklish Business, where we talk about classic films, she was kind enough to sit down and chat with us for about half an hour. You can listen to it wherever you get your podcasts, and we talked about a lot of things. She is just a delight. You know, I always worry about interviewing people that are still in the Disney fold, because they usually have talking points, you know, things you can talk to them about, things you are not allowed to talk to them about. And I was worried that she would be kind of similar in that, you know, the book talks about some heavy topics, you know, her struggles with bulimia or with anorexia, and her relationship with a man who was, you know, 40 years her senior. And she was really an open book. You know, we talked a lot about, you know, growing up in the public eye and being a young girl in this industry. And, you know, we talked, I did, you know, bring up our Moon Spinners episode, and, you know, how much of the criticism that I read at that time was about her appearance. We talked about Walt Disney and working on the lot and getting to work some of the amazing talents that she worked with, and how she did not think to appreciate them at the time. She was a young girl, but it was amazing. I was so happy that we got the chance to sit down and talk with her. And you know, if you want more Haley Mills stuff, and you want to head over to our Patreon at patreon.com/ticklishbiz, we also did an episode in Haley Mills' honor of our double features series, where we look at, you know, original and remakes, and we did talk about The Parent Trap, the original, and the Lindsay Lohan remake. So there's a lot of Haley Mills stuff over at the podcast right now, and it was just great to get to sit down with a Disney legend. Cross that off my bucket list.
Well, yeah, I'm looking forward to checking it out. And you know, it's interesting. I mean, I don't know how deep you dived into things, but you know, we think about Haley Mills as being a Disney star, but there's a lot of other aspects too. I know I've looked into some things, and you know, there's some other projects that she did beyond Disney that, you know, you kind of look at and you go, that's kind of an un-Disney type of storyline going on there and things like that. So she's not just a Disney girl, you know?
Yeah. We did talk to her about some of her British work. You know, we didn't have a ton of time, unfortunately, to kind of look at all of her movies, but my co-host Kimberly Pierce did a deep dive and watched a lot of her work leading up to this. And so we do talk a little bit about her British output and some of the weirder movies that she did as she got older.
Well, of course, the thing that I always remember as well is that the first season of the show that eventually became Saved by the Bell was actually a vehicle for Haley Mills. She was the central character of that as a teacher, and then moved on, and then it became all about Zack and Screech and stuff.
Exactly. If only.
All right. Well, that's all the news that we have this time. Let's talk about a short.
So we are talking about the 1941 Mickey Mouse short, A Gentleman's Gentleman, directed, of course, by one of many stalwart Disney animators at the time, Clyde Geronimi. This one, I have so many questions about
it. I thought this one was weird.
This is so weird, and I think vaguely offensive. This one has Mickey, voiced by Walt Disney still, having, I guess, a gentleman's Sunday where he's going to stay in bed, and he calls his butler, James, which is Pluto, to bring his food in on a tray, which Pluto does, and Pluto makes him his tea and is sent out with a quarter for the morning paper, and he eventually loses the quarter, or it's a dime, I guess. It's money. he loses it and gets it back with some bubble gum, and then gets the paper, but then the paper falls apart, and despite all of that, he finally gives the paper to Mickey, covered in mud. That's the plot, and it lasts 7 minutes.
That's the plot, but there's so many steps along the way with this where I thought, there's nothing logical about this short at all. There's all these strange things going on with Pluto that I'm like, well, why? Why is it turning out that way?
So let's start with the beginning, which is, so, okay, you've seen Stand By Me, Todd, right?
Yeah, just recently, as a matter of fact, I rewatched it.
Do you remember that part in Stand By Me where they're asking about what is Goofy?
Right.
Because Goofy acts like a human, but he's a dog, and Pluto is a dog. So I really need an answer to that now, because we just saw Pluto become, I'm assuming, an indentured servant to Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
I mean, he gives him a dime and, like, chastises him not to lose it. Like, really chastises him in a very un-Mickey way. This is a short that has, I think, a lot of black stereotyping, starting not just with the butlering thing, but the way that Pluto is, like, strutting down the street with the quarter in his mouth. Mm. You know, it's very much kind of like, oh, God, I can't think of the character from Porgy and Bess. But it's very similar to kind of, like, stereotypical depictions of, like, black males, you know, walking down the street. And then, of course, the short culminates with Pluto looking at the comic section, and there is some derogatory stereotyping of him in blackface, which is brought to fruition at the end when he himself falls into the mud and is presented in blackface. So, yeah, this is probably a short that, I don't know, Todd, did this come with one of those disclaimers?
It is in the vault section, yes, on the DVDs, where Leonard Maltin, you know, in a very calm way, you know, reminds you that it was a different time.
Maltin's heart.
You know, yeah, I mean, it is weird to start off with just, you know, the idea that, you know, best buds, Mickey and Pluto, and here you've got Pluto waiting on Mickey hand and foot, and Mickey's kind of being kind of a lazy jerk to start things off here. So that's an odd beginning for the short in general. And then, you know, the whole bit with the coin and losing it and such. First of all, I don't get why Pluto is carrying it around in his mouth, you know, in his teeth, because you're going, well, surely he's going to drop it here. So he's like flipping it off his tongue and things like that. And, you know, first of all, I go, that's gross. Do you know where the average coin has been? They're disgusting. But then, you know, he loses it down the sewer grate, and he's trying to reach for it with his paw. And I'm going, well, if you can grab it with your paw, why weren't you carrying it in your paw in the first place? And then he does the whole thing with sticking bubblegum to his tail to fish it out, which, you know, ends up being effective. But I mean, the whole thing with the bubblegum, he sees the bubblegum machine, goes over there. He gets this sly look on his face. And I think, okay, Pluto's going to bust open the bubblegum machine and take some coins and buy the paper that way. No, he instead fishes bubblegum out of there so he can, you know, chew that up and use it to stick to the coin when he shoves his tail down the sewer grate. And I'm thinking, well, he just stole all those bubblegums. What's stopping him from breaking open the machine and stealing all the money that's in there? So that didn't make any sense. And then when he finally gets the money back and he goes to get the paper machine, you know, like, it's got a slot for the coin, but I mean, you could totally just take a paper out of there and walk away. It's not like the paper machines we have now. So, I mean, if he's stealing gumballs, you know, he could have just stolen the paper and had it all over and done with. I'm not trying to advocate Disney characters stealing things here, but it makes no sense.
Let's talk about the fact that you described all of this. This is the main narrative of a 7-minute short, is him trying to get a newspaper home. And I really was just kind of like, this is not how I saw this short going from where it started.
Right.
And I think that's kind of the thing that frustrated me about this is, you know, if this is called A Gentleman's Gentleman, I would have liked to maybe see something about the struggles of Pluto as a butler.
Right.
Kind of having to deal with a snooty, jerkish Mickey Mouse who's kind of sending him from A to B and probably not respecting him. I mean, There's not a thank you in this short well, for all of the work.
He gives him a hug at the end. It ends with Mickey and Pluto hugging, but yeah.
This is Avengers logic, apparently. You get paid in goodwill. And that's kind of my thing, is I feel like there is a plot, but this feels like, and we've talked about this, you know, we're in the midst of the war by this point. This just kind of feels like lazy, we got to get a short out type of thinking. Like, what is a concept we can do that is, I don't want to say unoffensive because it is offensive, that is, I guess, overall non-taxing to the audience that we can kind of put out quickly?
Well, and you're absolutely right in that, you know, it starts in one place and ends in another. I mean, I totally thought it was going to be about Pluto being a butler type of thing, Mickey, you know, acting snooty or whatever. I think that would have had some promise. And I think that might have been the initial idea here. But then somehow they ran out of ideas and it became all about Pluto trying to get this coin out of the sewer. And yeah, that's just not as interesting. And then they run out of ideas with that, and it all becomes about the newspaper blowing around. And there's the weird thing about, you know, where Pluto starts looking through the paper and there's a comic strip that's a Pluto comic strip. And I'm like, so are Mickey and Pluto celebrities in the world that they are in? I never had the impression that it's like, you know, they were public figures before, that the world would know who they were, you know, that they pick up the newspaper and see Mickey and Donald and Pluto comic strips, or they go to the movies and see themselves on the movie screen. That just hit me the wrong way. I never, you know, thought that was the whole the idea here, that they were, you know, movie stars in all these shorts. I just thought we were watching silly cartoons about a mouse and his dog and his duck friend and whatever Goofy is.
Exactly. Yeah, I was really not into this short, just because, you know, we've seen shorts where, you know, the concept is very simple, you know, getting from A to B in one place, you know, that's the basis of a lot of shorts. But I think that this short wants to start somewhere, and then it just looks like they ran out of time, like you said, and it goes just down a really formulaic, forgettable road. I have no doubt that I won't remember this in a day. You know, and even some of the worst shorts we've seen, even the one, what's the undersea one that they consider the worst Disney short of all time?
Was that King Neptune?
Neptune. I don't remember the name, but I will remember that short just because it's so distinctive. There's nothing distinctive about this.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. All right, we're going to take a quick break here. We'll hear from another Lamb Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our look at The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Hello, everyone. This is JD from the In Session Film Podcast. Each week, we review
the latest from Hollywood, California.
Well, yes, Brendan. We also
give top three lists.
Okay, yeah. Thanks again, Brendan. Additionally, you can hear us
talk other movie news, trailers, varying movie series, or other interesting film-related topics, and even rants and raves of the week.
That's correct, Brendan. On top of our main show, every Friday,
you can also hear our extra film podcasts.
Good job, Brendan.
Thank you, JD. It's my goal to make you proud. You're the father, after all.
Yes, and I'm very proud. You can listen to the In Session Film podcast on
iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or at InSessionFilm.com.
Brendan, will you please let me complete just one?
Nope.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Listen to the In Session Film podcast every Monday and Friday. Subscribe today and hear me verbally beat JD like a Cherokee drum.
No. That's not how this works, sir.
Hey,
no.
Go cry at Midnight Special again, okay? That's what you're good for.
I will. You know what? And I'll do it while pummeling you. I'll do both at the same time.
How are you going to pummel me? Yeah, I don't buy it.
That's just how
did you suddenly forget where I live?
I know I'm late. I'm a swine.
It's 4 o'clock.
I just woke up.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
You just woke up.
Fausto and I, we took the boat out. We were fishing, and then it was dawn, and we caught absolutely nothing.
Yes. Well, we ate everything without you.
We?
Yes. Tom Ripley's here.
Who? Tom!
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you? I thought you disappeared. We were going to send out a search party.
No. No, still here.
Tom was telling me about his journey over. Made me laugh so hard I almost got a nosebleed.
Is that good?
Shut up.
I'm sorry. I'm despicable. But I love you. Do you love me? Do you love me?
I'm intruding.
Can you mix a martini?
Sure.
I'll do it.
Oh.
I make a fabulous martini.
Everybody should have one talent. What's yours?
Forging signatures, telling lies, impersonating practically anybody.
That's three. Nobody should have more than one talent. Okay. Do an impression.
Now? Huh. The only talent my son has is for cashing his allowance.
What?
Oh, I like to sail. Believe me, I love to sail. Instead, I make boats.
Stop!
Other people sail them.
It's too much. You're making all the hairs on my neck stand up.
Oh, yes, jazz. Oh, jazz. Let's face it. It's just insolent noise.
I feel like he's here. Horrible, like the old bastard's here right now.
Good.
That's brilliant. Brilliant. How do you know him?
I met him in New York.
Marge, this is scary. You've got to hear this. Meet my father, Herbert Richard Greenleaf the First.
Pleasure to meet you. Dickie's made a fine catch.
Uncanny.
I know Emily thinks so.
I don't get it.
It's uncanny.
Could you ever conceive of going to Italy, Tom, and bringing him back?
What?
I'd pay you if you would go to Italy, persuade my son to come home. I'd pay you $1,000.
All right, so our feature film this time comes from 1999. It's The Talented Mr. Ripley, directed by Anthony Minghella. This was his follow-up to The English Patient, which, of course, won the Best Picture Oscar and won him the Best Director Oscar as well. So this was a prestige pick when it came out in late 1999, based on the 1955 novel by Patricia Highsmith. Minghella wrote the screenplay. It got a lot of attention back then, a lot of awards recognition, 5 Academy Award nominations, but it won none of them. One of those films that gets a lot of attention for nominations, but then comes up empty on Oscar night. I remember seeing this when it came out, and it was kind of a big deal because it had a lot of just like a who's who of these, you know, young up and coming actors in it. I only watched it the one time back then. So this was a 20 year overdue revisit for me. I think Kristen, though, like watches this thing religiously, if I remember correctly.
I've seen The Talented Mr. Ripley several times. I saw it when it came out in 99. I made my mother go take me to see it. Awkward conversations were probably had, but I loved it. This started me off, I think, on like many a teen girl, you know, we all became Jude Law fans. I think it's one of those where it's a fascinating example of a lot of things in 1999. It's an example of what a prestige picture looked like in the late 90s. It's an example of kind of what pretentious filmmaking looked like in the late 90s. It's a very dated, yet at the time it was rather groundbreaking, look at same-sex relationships in the late 1990s. I recently, when I rewatched it, I read the book for the first time alongside it, and to read the book and to see the movie is very interesting, because the Minghella makes some choices with this movie that I don't necessarily think Highsmith would have made.
Well, that'll be interesting to hear kind of the comparison between the two, because I have no knowledge of the book. But why don't you give us the lowdown on the basics of the storyline here, and then we can dig into it some more.
Yeah, so this is an adaptation of the first Tom Ripley novel. I think Patricia Highsmith would write 3 in in her lifetime. And it follows a young American named Tom Ripley, played by Matt Damon, who is approached by a shipping magnate to go to Italy under the guise of believing that Tom is a fellow classmate of his son Dickie, played by Jude Law. The goal is for Dickie to come back to America. He has been living it for several years in a small Italian village where he spends his days sailing his boat, playing music and sleeping with whoever shows up. and so Tom goes there, hopefully to get him to come home, but along the way becomes very taken with Dickie's life and with Dickie himself, and starts to assume that maybe he can become Dickie Greenleaf, and complications, murder ensues. It's all set in the 1950s as well, so a lot of good costumes, good hair.
Good costumes, good hair, good music, good scenery, all kinds of stuff like that. So
a lime green bathing suit that will haunt your nightmares.
So where should we start on this? I mean, there's so much to dig into. You mentioned like kind of the fascination with Jude Law that came about for a lot of young ladies because of this. And one of the things I always remember about this film is that I think it's where a lot of people were introduced to Jude Law. And of course he got an Academy Award nomination out of this. And I think is one of the standout things about this film.
Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, this was not the first time that The Talented Mr. Ripley had been adapted for film. Before this, there had been a French version called Purple Noon in English, with Alain Delon as Tom Ripley, that was very different. We can talk about that when we talk about, you know, the use of same-sex material that ends up in here. But this was a movie that was very close to Anthony Minghella's heart. And I want to say that he fought very hard to get Jude Law, and Jude Law was worried that he wasn't going to be good enough for it. And you know, I think that he's great. Everybody's good in this movie. I think that's,
oh yeah,
that's the high point, is that everybody is really good. But I think that what Jude Law brings to Dickie in this is, it's easy to see why really anybody would want to either be a part of his life or take over his life, because you know, the way Jude Law plays the character is just so magnetic and so charismatic. I think at one point, Gwyneth Paltrow's character, Marge, who is his girlfriend, says, you know, he looks at you and it's like the sun shines, and then it goes away and it's very cold. And you can see all of that. You know, he understood the assignment, and just really makes you loathe him because you know he's horrible.
Right.
But at the same time, he is the like perfect embodiment of white male privilege, where you're just like, I get it. I hate it, but I get it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing. He is so magnetic in this, but you're right. I mean, I watch and I go, well, this guy's disgusting. You know, I can say that about most of the characters in this film. You know, I don't think deep down any of them are all that good of human beings. You know, it is an interesting achievement when you have Jude Law being so memorable in this film. And then when you sit down and think about it, you go, and he's not even in 2/3 of the movie.
No, he's not. Spoiler alert, he is not in the majority of this movie. And I think that that's something that's surprising to a lot of people, you know, considering that Matt Damon's playing Ripley, who is trying to be Dickie after a certain point when Dickie goes away. Spoiler alert, you already know this.
Yeah.
Most people should know Dickie ends up dying.
Right, right.
He's murdered. And Tom takes over his life. And, you know, I think a lot of people would be surprised to be like, well, how does that work out? Matt Damon and Jude Law don't look the same at all. And I think that the movie does a really skillful job of saying that it's not necessarily who looks like Dickie Greenleaf, it's who gives off the air.
Right.
And Matt Damon has that ability. You know, there's a great moment at the end of, towards the end of the film, when Tom has, you know, got all this money and he's living in this beautiful house, and Marge shows up and she says, he notices how comfortable he is with it. And I think that that's what this movie really captures. And I it's hard to believe at the time bigger names, because I think that's what a lot of people fail to realize, is when this came out in 99, Matt Damon was fresh off of Good Will Hunting,
mm-hmm.
you know, had won the Oscar for writing. This was a follow-up film, and a lot of people thought, much like Leonardo DiCaprio following up Titanic with The Man in the Iron Mask, that this was going to be some type of career killer, because Tom Ripley was not openly gay, but gay character in 99, Matt Damon being a straight actor was still very taboo. So a lot of people assumed this would hurt him, and it really didn't at the time. And it's shocking to believe that Leonardo DiCaprio actually declined this. He refused to play Tom Ripley, and Matt Damon did it. But I think that him and Jude Law at the time were not necessarily equally cast, but they have the equal levels of talent that they pull off their characters and that eventual switch very well.
See, and I don't know that DiCaprio would have been.
Oh, he would have
vibe.
Been horrible.
I don't think it would have been the right feel. I mean, and you know, I got nothing against DiCaprio. I mean, you know, there's a lot of his work that I have a great deal of respect for. But you know, coming off of Titanic at that point in his career, I don't know. I don't think DiCaprio was there yet, you know?
There's too much cockiness, I think, with DiCaprio. You know, it's hard to believe. Tom Ripley, at least in this iteration, this is not Highsmith's Ripley, I think, and it's not even necessarily, I mean, I guess if you wanted to do Alain Delon's Ripley, DiCaprio might have been better. He's a smoother type of character. But here, I mean, Tom Ripley is
kind of a schlub.
Yeah, exactly. He's the Rick Moranis of
right.
this landscape. You know, he lives in a dump. You know, he doesn't have a whole lot going for him and really doesn't seem very motivated to do anything about it. It isn't until he gets this free ride to go to Italy that he starts thinking that his motivation would be to ingratiate himself with these people. So I don't think you could have had a Leonardo DiCaprio, somebody that looks like you're like, oh, you're a loser. Like, I don't buy that at all.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that really grabbed me this time is, you know, again, thinking back 20-some years, I remember Jude Law being so interesting and magnetic in this film. I didn't remember how captivating Matt Damon is, and he's captivating because he's so pathetic in this. You know, he comes off as so awkward and desperate, you know, in so many moments. And, you know, the way he's still able to just twist that and make it work for him, I just found that so captivating this time.
Exactly. I mean, I think Matt Damon's performances as Tom in this, again, I'm prefacing all of this with this is not Highsmith's Ripley, but I think the way he plays it, you feel for him. You feel for his character in some instances, specifically in the second half of the movie, where as he's being more manipulative and he is trying so desperately to get one half of his life, whether that's the Dickie side or the Tom side, to go away so that he can enjoy. I mean, the whole point of the movie is that he has a hard time enjoying what he has amassed because there are people that know him as Tom. Mm-hmm. And so much of that is trying to live this other life. And, you know, he eventually meets a man, Peter Smith Kingsley, played by a pre-Pirates of the Caribbean, Jack Davenport. And there's this relationship that develops. And at the end, you know, we can talk about the end when the time comes, but his decision at the end is, you know, you feel for him, especially, I think, for a lot of people that were gay at the time or remembered being gay in the 1950s. You know, there's a whole big honking metaphor in this movie about kind of living two lives and having to kill one half of that when you can't be who you are.
Mm. I guess the thing that stands out to me the most with Damon here is that, you know, throughout the whole film, you just see him gradually become more and more of a despicable character. And I'm sitting there going, I should hate this guy. But yet out of all the characters in this film, he's the one that I do feel for. You know, I mean, when I sit there and you're surrounded by, you know, this jerk that's played by Jude Law, Gwyneth Paltrow, I mean, as sweet as Gwyneth Paltrow can be, there's things about her character that I just go,
See, we're going to disagree because I sympathize with Marge the most. Marge is right. At the end of the movie, she is right. She is right about everything. And the men are just like, honey, go put some lipstick on. You're hysterical.
Well, I guess what I'm more saying is it's kind of that privileged and I'm going to go off to Italy and write my book type of thing that I just go, oh, yeah, go get a real job and then write your book. You know what I mean?
Well, Dickie's doing the same thing, too.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
Go play the trumpet. So.
And he doesn't have an ounce of talent. You know, that's the thing. And then, you know, talking about the characters that just rub me the wrong way. I mean, Philip Seymour Hoffman. This is one of the ultimate Philip Seymour Hoffman jerk roles. I mean, it just oozes off the screen.
Yeah. Again, Freddie Miles is very different in the book than he is in on the screen. And I think, you know, this is one of the quintessential PSH roles. And I think he plays a cad so well. I mean, where Dickie is kind of false bravado and charm, you know, like he can still get people to support him. You know, Freddie Miles is that textbook, like, gross American mm-hmm. that, you know, is crass and vulgar and, you know, makes fun of everybody. He especially makes fun of Tom. He's the bully. You know, he's definitely the character that I think is very much of a bully that even, again, when he gets his comeuppance, there's so many characters, and I think what I love about Minghella's script is that there's so many characters that even though they are correct and they understand what Tom is doing, because of how they act and the sense of privilege and the class distinctions aren't nearly as heavy as they are in the novel. The novel is very much about class, but I think a lot of what Minghella is playing with is that these characters would be far more sympathetic if they didn't lord their status over this guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and just, I mean, they're kind of textbook of that whole concept of, well, I can get away with anything. And, you know, and then it's actually Tom that ends up being the one that gets away with everything. But I just, at every turn, these characters, you know, whether it's Philip Seymour Hoffman, whether it's Jude Law's character, there's just all these things that you think, you know, well, I mean, I'd end up in prison if that were me, you know, if I tried that, you know, I don't have the prestige. I don't have the money, you know, and that, you know, you're getting by because you're somebody special, all that. I mean, like one element, and maybe you have more insight on this from the book, the relationship between Jude Law and the local girl in the village.
Yeah.
You know, that's a part of this that I always think there's something still hanging there. When I watched it, I was going, did she really, again, we're in spoiler here, guys, did she really kill herself? Or is Dickie responsible for this? You know,
I have no reason to believe Sylvana did not kill herself. So I don't get that angle per se, but to go back to one of the points that you were making about kind of getting away with murder, so to speak, you know, there's an element of this movie that would only work in the time period in which it was set, you know, and even I think in the time period in which it was filmed, because this is a movie that has Clark Kent syndrome, because, you know, there are so many instances where Tom should get caught.
Right.
You know, their characters show up, you know, at one point in the close to the end of the movie, he assumes that the detective that interviewed him as Tom is going to show up and see that he is acting as Dickie. You know, there's so many instances, and there's a lot of the movie and Highsmith's novel that is reliant on luck and fate, you mm-hmm. know, very much, and I hate to name drop him, but it very much in a way like Woody Allen does, where, you know, some people are just born lucky, and that is Tom. He may not be a lucky man in America, but he makes his luck in Italy, and he succeeds. You know, I think of this, you know, coming just a year or two after another adaptation of a famous book, American Psycho, and the concept of that movie playing with, like, all white men look alike. And that's kind of the joke throughout the movie, is that nobody remembers what Patrick Bateman really looks like. And I think that this movie kind of plays with that too, in the sense that, like, no one really knows anybody in this world, that these characters all just kind of flit in and out of each other's lives, that they wouldn't even recognize them on the street because they're that wrapped up in their own thing. But to go back to Dickie's relationship as a womanizer, you know, shockingly in the book is very, very slim in the story department. And there's a very cold kind of asexual relationship between Dickie and Marge and Tom. Marge and Dickie in the book are not together. They live next door to each other and they're good friends. And Marge makes it known that she is, you know, certainly in love with Dickie, but they are not in a relationship. And Dickie is very much not a womanizer in the book. And Highsmith plays a lot with, does that mean he's gay? Does that mean he's asexual? Does that just mean he doesn't care? You know, like, I think there's a lot of things, you know, Highsmith was bisexual or gay, depending on what you read. But her book does not deal with sexuality in the same as overtly as this movie does, partly because at the time she wrote it, she couldn't really be as out with her characters. And there's certainly a lot of antipathy between Marge and Tom. You know, Tom in the book talks about how much he hates Marge because she's ugly and she's a woman, and you can read that as, like, he hates her because, you know, he wants Dickie for himself, and she's this third wheel that he hates. And at the same time, Marge talks, you know, and makes aspersions about, you know, believing that maybe Tom and Dickie are into each other. But a lot of that is all talked around, you know, and it's, I mean, it's very frank for the 1950s in which Highsmith wrote, but it's very different than this. And I think that what's amazing reading the book and watching the movie is that for the movies at the time, kind of shocking, oh, Matt Damon's playing a gay man. You know, Highsmith's writing this book where it's just like, yeah, maybe these characters are gay. I don't know. We're just going to move on. Like, it just, it's there, but she's not going to talk about it because it's not relevant. Or is it relevant? Like, I love how Highsmith really kind of keeps you guessing and she gives you no easy answers. And I know that that was one of the big criticisms of the film when it came out, was that, you know, Tom Ripley in this version, at least, is, you know, the sad, tragic gay man who has to live his life alone because, you know, he can't be out and proud. So it's a very weird kind of transition, the way Minghella adapted it.
Well, and at the same time, I there are moments where I wrestle with what really is Ripley's position in all of this, to speak, because there's times where I go, well, is he just... is everything he does just a step towards getting more, reaching his goal? You know, when he has that relationship with the other guy, you know, further down in the movie, I'm going, well, is this legit, or does he just see this as this is the next step?
A means to an end. Yeah, exactly. Well, you also have the character of Meredith, played by Cate Blanchett, who is the woman that he meets at the beginning of the movie. She's an heiress. She believes that he is Dickie Greenleaf right away, and she pops in and out of his life throughout the movie. Meredith is not a character in the novel at all. That was created by Minghella. And I think, again, a lot of that leaves the audience to question, you know, it becomes all about his sexuality in the movie, which is very fascinating, you know, based on which person he ends up with, does that determine whether he's gay or straight? You know, does, if he ends up with Meredith, is he in love with Meredith? Is it a lavender marriage? You know, where does that fall? And so, you know, I think, and I love Cate Blanchett in a very minor role.
I'd totally forgotten she was in this movie.
Exactly. You know, Minghella was very surprised that she wanted to do this because he thought it was definitely beneath her talents. But, you know, I do also wonder if a lot of that is, you know, in the 90s, we saw what has been coined as the heterosexual buffer, which is like you have to have a woman in there to make the audience think that these characters might be straight. And I do wonder if Meredith was kind of there because Minghella worried that maybe, like, we have to have something so that people don't think Damon is, like, definitely gay. Like, he can still get a woman.
Mm. Well, and, you know, it just... you kind of bringing up that subject, just kind of the, how do I put it? Just the sexually charged nature of this film. And I kind of was looking real quick just to remind myself of where we were at with things in 1999 and just kind of giving a quick skimming over some 1999 titles. And I thought, oh my, this was a rather sexually charged year. I mean, we're looking at, this is the same year as American Beauty. This is the same year as Cruel Intentions, Eyes Wide Shut. I mean, you know, this was quite a hot and bothered year.
Yeah, the late, you know, 99, the people have said that, you know, there's the 90s and then there's 99, which felt very much like a turning point as we're entering the new millennium. And there were a lot of, you know, not just sexually charged things, but slow kind of toe dipping into more taboo topics. This is also the year of Boys Don't Cry, with Hilary Swank, which again was a, you know, at the time, groundbreaking LGBTQ feature, even though you know, straight actress is playing a character, straight cis actress playing a trans woman. So there's definitely change in the air, and I think a lot of young women, especially around my age, love this movie, much like we love The English Patient for what I call its horny elegance. You know, it's one of those movies where everybody is like hot and bothered, but they're in like prim and proper clothing, and there's a lot of repression and tension. You're like, what's going to happen here? You know, this is a whole movie where you have two people talking and one of them's in a bathtub. It's just, it's very erotically charged.
Well, and the English patient is, I mean, you talked about kind of pretentiousness earlier, and I mean, yeah, I think there's a pretentiousness to the talented Mr. Ripley, but it's nothing compared to the English patient.
Yeah, the English patient's definitely pretentious. I saw it once. I liked it, but I haven't seen it again. Who knows if I feel the same way. Yeah. But I think what this movie does, too, you know, is that there's so much. I think what shocks people is the 1950s was still very much associated with repression. And, you know, mom and pop and sleeping in separate beds. And this is a film where you definitely believe everybody is having sex with everybody, and maybe it's also, you know, same-sex oriented, or at least wanting to be. You know, even that moment where Marge discovers the rings and she's freaking out because it proves that Tom has murdered Dickie, and he's coming out of the bathroom and he's in a towel, and there's this whole like discussion between them that's very heated, and you know, he drops the towel and he's nude, and you're just kind of like, it's such a mix of emotions, because again, there's the threat and then there's sex. And it's not the threat of sexual violence necessarily, but it's those two separate spheres inhabiting one exchange.
You know, you brought up something there a moment ago that made me go, oh, we haven't talked about the murder scene. The murder on the boat is one of the things that stands out to me about this movie, because this isn't a movie that, I mean, is, you know, one you think of in terms of being a graphic, bloody type of movie. But I find that the scene where Ripley kills Dickie to just be so shocking when it happens.
Yeah.
You know, I know it's coming, but it's still shocking.
It's very different in the book. If anything, I think it's written far gorier in the book than it is on screen, just because it's like describing Tom beating him into a bloody pulp. I think like flesh is flying in the air as he's beating him with this boat oar. And I think a lot of, I talk about this movie as one where tension just builds and builds to a crescendo. And it's so perfectly conveyed in this scene, because, you know, Dickie's done with him. He's pretty much like, well, you got no money. I'm not going back home, so we're done. Like, our friendship is over. You can go back to your life, and I'm going to go back to being awesome. So it's been nice. And they go out on this boat, you know, for one last haroo. And, you know, I think that Tom definitely implies some stuff. You know, he really does think that Dickie might be maybe bisexual or into him. And just the way that it builds to Dickie just kind of telling him, you know, you're a leech. You're on me. Everything about you annoys me. And when that boat oar finally hits him and it's just blood, I mean, it's shocking, because you're like, this guy, Matt Damon, like,
right. Yeah.
He's been so sweet. Like, what is happening here?
Well, and then, you know, in the aftermath too, you're still like, well, I know what I just saw, but poor Matt Damon, you know?
Exactly. And that's so different than Highsmith, and even really Alain Delon's performance in 1960. You know, Alain Delon played the character very cool, very confident. He's a con man, you know, in 1960, pure and simple. You know, that's all he is. Whereas in the book, you know, I think Tom Ripley has a lot in common with, you know, your Patrick Batemans, not necessarily your Hannibal Lecters, but in the sense that, like, he is a guy that is just very cold. He has no connections to people. He doesn't even really know how to form social attachments. You know, maybe you consider that a sociopath, maybe not, you know. She writes him very ambiguously and very ill-defined, so that you don't really know where you stand with him. And Minghella makes him far more sympathetic, so that even when he's beating him with a boat oar, you can tell he feels bad.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I feel like, you know, by the time we get to the end of the movie, yeah, I think, you know, Ripley is, you know, a psychopath, basically. But, you know, you feel like as the movie progresses that he's just kind of falling into it. You know, he didn't necessarily start the movie that way, but, you know, with one bit of luck after another, like what you said, he sees how it works to his advantage, and then he embraces it.
I think at the end, even then, he's a psychopath. You know, I think what you said is very apropos. He's a man that sees advantage. And I think at the end of the movie, when he commits his final murder that we see on screen with Peter, it does go back to that sexuality angle where it's, you know, this is one of the few people that knows that he's Tom in Italy or in Europe. And he's the last vestige of that old, possibly homosexual guy that he doesn't want to be. And so he has to kill him off. It's why I love, you know, I know people don't really care for Gwyneth Paltrow in this movie. And I don't care for her as a person, but I think I really love Marge in this movie. I think Minghella did a better job of presenting her than Highsmith did in the book. Because much like where Tom is trying to shed his gender construct of like, I want to be this guy, but I also maybe want to be somebody that's not defined by being gay and being an outsider. You know, Marge doesn't want to be defined by being a woman. And at the end of the movie, when she goes back to America, you know, it's with the knowledge that she knows that he did it. He did everything. And she can't get anybody to believe her. So it's this really interesting contrast of where Tom is able to get everything he wants and succeed. You know, is it because he's a man? We don't really know. But poor Marge has to go back to America with all of this knowledge, and she just can't get people to believe her because she is a woman.
Yeah. Well, we should talk a little bit about how this movie was received, box office, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so this had a budget of about $40 million, which is pretty big for an independent film. Well, not independent, but this was not, you know, released to millions of screens to blockbuster status. But it did receive generally positive reviews. Most people liked it. Roger Ebert gave it a 4 out of 4. There was some criticism at the time, again, about Matt Damon not being a gay actor, playing a possibly gay character. But it was not as, I think, virulent as it would be if the same thing was happening today. This has been considered, you know, a landmark film for a lot of directors who came to love Anthony Minghella. There was a different movie made based on another Highsmith movie called Ripley's Game a couple years later with John Malkovich playing an older Ripley that is somewhat in line with Highsmith's book. That is a very different movie with a very different Ripley character. The books get a bit weird with Ripley as characters they go on because there was a lot of time in between. But this was nominated for 5 Academy Awards as well. Best Music, Costume Design, which I'm shocked it didn't win. Art Direction, Screenplay, and Jude Law as Supporting Actor. In case you'd like to know who won, would you Todd, I'm going to have you guess. So, supporting actor, Jude Law, Talented Mr. Ripley, Michael Clark Duncan for The Green Mile, Michael Caine for The Cider House Rules, Haley Joel Osment for The Sixth Sense, and Tom Cruise for Magnolia. Who won?
I remember this. I believe it was Michael Caine.
Yep. Yes. This is where I say The Cider House Rules sucks.
thinking through those movie again, I'm going, you know, if I had to choose today, I probably choose Jude Law, I think.
And in case you're curious why the Talented Mr. Ripley did not win costume design, the other nominees that year were Titus, Anna and the King, Jenny Bevan, which is, again, some great names here, Sleepy Hollow, Colleen Atwood, and the winner was the movie Topsy Turvy. If you have not heard of it, you are in good company because neither have I.
I've heard of it. Haven't seen it, but I've heard of it.
And then in case anybody wants to know a screenplay, what best did this for screenplay, Todd, I'm going to have you guess again. The Talented Mr. Ripley, The Insider, The Green Mile, Cider House Rules, or Election?
Well, I'm cheating here because I just pulled up the page. It's The Cider House Rules again here.
John Irving. It still sucks. Yeah.
And I mean, Talented Mr. Ripley, I'd probably put that in strong contention. I'd probably have to narrow that one down to Ripley and Election.
Ooh, see, you know, 1999 is a weird year because now so many of those movies are problematic and in some cases gross. And I say that as somebody who up until several years ago would have told you American Beauty was one of her favorite movies. And this was not nominated for Best Picture at all. If I had to knock one of the movies, so Todd, I'm curious. If you had to knock one of the five that was nominated and nominate this, Cider House Rules, The Insider, Sixth Sense, Green Mile, American Beauty, what would you knock out to make room for The Talented Mr.?
Oh, boy, that's tough. There's one or two of those I haven't seen. But, I mean, as much as I like having, you know, representation from, like, box office champs, you know, so that it's not just all the snooty stuff, you know, I don't know that The Sixth Sense is really the Sixth Sense gets by on its shock ending,
oh,
you know?
Oh, no. The Sixth Sense is great.
I'm not saying it's not great. I'm just saying that I think a lot of times shock endings give a lot more impact to things. I mean, it's like, you know, people rag on me for this, but, you know, like Chinatown has this shock ending. And I think for a lot of people, that makes it a lot more interesting film than it is for me. So, you know.
Oh, no, The Sixth Sense deserves that Best Picture nom. Thank you. I would dump Cider House Rules. Maybe The Insider. I've seen The Insider twice. I don't care for it. But I would keep that as long as I never had to remember that the Cider House Rules exist.
Well, see, Cider House Rules is another one where just like, you know, Ripley, it's been 20 years probably since I'd seen it. So, yeah, my memory's not as fresh, I'm afraid.
Nope. Lasse Hallström and his Kings of New England and I, we will never see eye to eye.
Oh, boy. So how did this do in the box office? Because, again, it's small release. You know, it got a lot of good word of mouth, but, it's not your Thanksgiving Day opening blockbuster type of a thing.
No, but it did make a fair amount of money. Based on that budget, it did make $128.8 million. It doesn't say how well that was in the grand scheme of things. But considering its budget, I mean, that's pretty successful in my opinion.
Yeah. And I mean, it certainly was kind of like what we said at the beginning, you know, this kind of launch pad for a lot of these people. I mean, we'd seen them earlier, but I think this is the movie where people really were like, oh, this Matt Damon guy, this Jude Law guy, this Gwyneth Paltrow, this Philip Seymour Hoffman.
I can tell you that it was number one opening weekend, right? And that was in a weekend. This went wide Christmas Day of 99. You also had stuff like Any Given Sunday in its third week. The Green Mile was in its fifth. And the only other new release that entered the top five that year was Galaxy Quest.
There's your best picture winner. Should have been Galaxy Quest.
Exactly. The number one that the talented Mr. Ripley dethroned was Stuart Little.
Oh.
So 99 had some good, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
All right, well, we should talk about some pins here, and then we will do our ratings. So if ever in a strange multiverse type of way there were to be pins at the Disney store down at, on Main Street for the talented Mr. Ripley, what would they be?
Well, Jude Law in a bathtub, obviously. The ring that he wears, that becomes a MacGuffin in this movie. I'd also say I love Gwyneth Paltrow's looks, so any of her 1950s looks would be great. And Freddie Miles in his car would be a must.
See, now I'm going to go the other way with Freddie Miles and say the bust that Ripley kills him with.
Yes.
And then, of course, the corduroy suit.
Yeah.
Got to have that. All right. So what are you going to rate this film on our scale of 5 Mickey heads?
Oh, my gosh. This gets a 4.5. I love this movie. I was very happy that I got to revisit it and read the book. I think both the Highsmith novel and this work very well as separate entities as opposed to straight adaptation. But everybody's great. It's a movie I don't get sick of, and I appreciate all of it. So I love this.
I'm right there with you. I say 4.5 as well. I mean, when I was done watching this movie, like I said, it's been 20 years probably since I've seen it. I went, dang, I'd forgotten what a good movie this is. You know, it had me captivated the whole time. You know, sometimes when you're revisiting something you've seen before, you know, you drift a little bit. Oh, I remember this scene or whatever. No, I was sucked in. It was like seeing it for the first time. This is a legit, really, really good movie. All right. Well, that's going to do it for our discussion of The Talented Mr. Ripley. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this film or any of the other films we've talked about. So please feel free to email us at waltsentmepodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at waltsentmepod and on Facebook, which is where?
Facebook.com/waltsentmepod.
And Kristen, tell everybody where they can find you, especially your Haley Mills episode there.
Yeah, we are wherever you get your podcasts, including Spotify, Audible, all of the things. You can also listen to us directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com. And if you'd like to support us with your money and get access to our double features episode on The Parent Trap, we also have our episode coming up on the dueling versions of 13 Ghosts for Halloween. You can head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz.
And as for me, you can find my site, which is called Forgotten Films, over at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. That's also where you'll find links to my other podcast, which is called The Forgotten Filmcast. And you can follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. All right, so what are we talking about next time?
We are only going back 1 year from when this came out. We're talking about pretentious filmmaking of the late 90s. We are talking about Wes Anderson's high school set feature, Rushmore. Yeah.
All right, well, we'll talk about that next time. Until then, we'll see you later.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.